You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For today's episode, we are traveling back to August of 2021. It's an episode we have never shared publicly before. It's only ever been on Patreon, mainly because it was a casual conversation we recorded on our phone. So forgive the audio. But we have now been following this case for nearly 3 years and feel the need to start discussing it publicly in more detail. It's the heartbreaking case of Matthew Coleman. 1 week before we recorded this conversation at our kitchen table on August 8th, 2021, Matthew Coleman, a 40-year-old Santa Barbara, California surf teacher and married family man, killed his two young children. His wife, Abby, reported that Matthew had taken their children from their California home and left suddenly as they prepared for a family camping trip. He took his children to Mexico. And the next day, as Matthew crossed back into the United States, he was taken into custody and he confessed to killing 2-year-old Kaleo and 10-month-old Roxy. He said it was necessary. According to the probable cause, Coleman had been following QAnon and Illuminati conspiracy theories and had recently received visions and signs indicating that Abby had passed serpent DNA to their children. The serpent DNA was going to make Kaleo and Roxy grow up to become monsters. Matthew said he knew what he did was wrong, but he was saving the world. In the next couple of episodes, we delve deeper into this story. But here are our initial thoughts the week this tragic case unfolded, recorded again on our phone at our dinner table.
Hidden, a true crime podcast. A forensic psychologist and a journalist explore the hidden motives behind unthinkable crimes while examining our deepest fears along the way.
Hello, Patreon supporters. We're sitting at our kitchen table, and we want to talk tonight about a case that is not the Daybell case, a case that happened last week, Matthew Coleman. Many of you mentioned on our Facebook page that you would be interested in hearing about this case. For those of you that don't know, a little background. Last week, a father who happens to also own a surfing school in California, he is a big surfer, took his 2-year-old and 10-month-old without telling his wife in his car, without any car seats, drove to Mexico. The wife, Abby, didn't know where he had gone, called police, concerned for their welfare. She didn't seem to imply that she knew that he would harm the children, but she was concerned for their well-being and didn't know what was going on. The next day, police discovered that he was in Mexico, and when they found him, they discovered that he had murdered his two children, that he had stabbed them with a spear fishing gun multiple times. And the reason he gave to police is that he believed the children would grow up to be monsters, that his wife had demon DNA. they referenced QAnon and the probable cause as a conspiracy theory that he believed in. It was really shocking. It, of course, reminded me of the Daybell case. Very upsetting. And so here I am looking at my husband, hoping that he can shed some light on this. So Dr. John, what is going on here?
I think there's a lot going on. Since we don't know all the details at this point, I want to talk about the Coleman case in broad terms. So what we do know is that he believed that the children had serpent DNA, that they were going to grow up to be monsters. We know that he had a lot of involvement in QAnon. We're not exactly sure the connection between those two things. We also know that he was fairly religious. I don't know if he was extreme in his religious beliefs, but certainly more on that side.
Christian. A very strong Christian. He had a lot of Christian posts on his Facebook. We've already delved into social media with multiple family members. Yes.
So let's the way I want to dive into this case would be to talk about paternal filicide. So we talked about maternal filicide a lot with Lori Daybell.
To clarify for our listeners, maternal filicide is a mother killing their children. Filicide is killing
right.
their children. So paternal is the
yeah.
father killing
yeah,
their
so
children.
Yeah, so let me clarify that actually. So filicide is when a parent kills a child. It can be the mother or the father. Believe it or not, it's more common for it is not more common for mothers to kill their kids. That fathers do it fairly often. Seems like we don't hear about that as much, but they're not exactly equal. Mothers kill their children more, but fathers do kill their kids. There's also something called infanticide, which is just killing children in general.
Huh.
There's something else called familicide, which is similar to family annihilation. Familicide is usually when a parent, usually a father, kills the children and the wife and sometimes himself. So familicide is essentially killing the whole family, often a murder-suicide type situation.
And that's more a man doing that, if that happens?
Yeah, it's usually, you know, in fact, there was a case in Las Vegas last year where a firefighter took the lives of his kids and his wife, and then he killed himself. So about half the time in familicide, if it is the husband or the male partner, about half the times it'll be a murder-suicide. And then the other half of the times it'll be simply murders that the children and the mother will be killed. So another case of familicide is the famous case from Cold podcast.
Oh, right. Josh Powell, Susan Powell and his children.
Right.
Although that was really drawn out. He killed her
yeah.
and attempted to keep the children alive, but I guess decided
right.
at the end when he came.
Well, he killed the wife, he killed his kids, and then he killed himself. So that was familicide. So, and then there's another type of family type homicide called neonaticide, which is killing children under 24 months or sometimes, depending, it's usually defined as 24 months and under, but sometimes 12 months and under. So in other words, very young infants.
It's almost like that.
Right. So this is a case of that as well. I mean, I think we would call it filicide because there's two kids, but
mm-hmm.
but the youngest was 10 months old, right? Or
right.
12, 10 months old.
The youngest
old.
Was 10 months old, a
yeah.
little girl. And the oldest was 2. I don't know how many months, but
so
2 years old.
So you have different versions of you know, unfortunately, killing children here and different categories of that, I guess. But looking at some of the research on fathers or paternal filicide, fathers who kill their kids, the research suggests there's essentially two types of paternal filicide. The first type involves fathers who are psychopathic or have some history of violence usually. And clearly, we would say that Matthew Coleman, who has no criminal past at all, no criminal record.
I did do a background check. Nothing I could find.
He seems to have a clean record. He doesn't seem to fit the category of a psychopath. So that leads us to the second category, which is called the emotionally overloaded type. And so I assume that he fits this category. My guess is that would suggest that this is someone who doesn't cope well with stress. Since we don't know what the stressors are at this point, I don't want to speculate on that, but I think it's fair to say that there was a lot of stress somehow in his life. I don't know if that could have been related to his work and the surfing school or maybe his marriage. I'm not sure, but or perhaps it was related to his involvement in some conspiracy groups. I don't know, but for whatever reasons, he was feeling very emotionally overloaded and he was stressed and anxious. And he saw this, I think, as a way to kind of alleviate that anxiety. I know that sounds crazy, but because he was so inundated with stress, he saw one solution, obviously a crazy solution or certainly not a rational solution. The solution being to take his children to Mexico and to murder them. So I think that's a good place to start. You know, I think you'd have to start with somebody who's overwhelmed, somebody who doesn't have the resources or the resiliency to cope with that stress, somebody who is probably creating a lot of that stress on his own, right? A lot of it is internally generated because he's involved in all these conspiracies. And apparently he was jumping on all types of internet groups. And I mean, we'll learn more over time, of course. But I think some of this stress was clearly internally generated from these groups.
Could he have turned to the conspiracy theories to not deal with real life too, though? Because I did learn a little bit about his real life. Let me just throw this out here. He was 40. His wife was 35. They had not been married that long. They're both very Christian. So my guess, this is me guessing with some evidence in front of me, that they got married quickly and started a family very quickly. I saw where they did get engaged not too long ago. They were not married long before they had children. And they had a 2-year-old and a 10-month-old. Right. They were renting their house. I know that they didn't own.
Okay.
And they had started this surfing school, which seemed to be doing really well. It had already been recognized as a great school. But I just want to share that. His life clearly changed drastically within 5 years.
Right.
So that's something.
Yeah. So again, I mean, any of those would be major stressors. You know, getting married, believe it or not, is considered one of the top five highest stressors, right? What?
Just kidding. No.
Certainly not getting married to me.
No, marriage was wonderful. It was the child that was the major stressor.
Right. And having that? A child. Yeah. Having a child. Yeah. Having a child is another one of the top five stressors too. So
we got married thinking we were having three. And now we're done.
Right. Now one feels like five. So, especially trying to do our podcast and work independently from home, it can be really overwhelming at times. So, in that sense, I can relate to Matthew Coleman. Of course, I would never consider what he considered, but let's go down the path of how he got there. So let's start with this idea of being emotionally overloaded. He's overwhelmed. He's struggling to cope with the stress. And yeah, you know, the business was fairly young, right? Maybe there were some issues there.
Right.
Maybe the business was struggling. We went on their website. We looked at the business. Of course, if you look at this couple and this family on Instagram or social media, they look like the absolutely perfect family, right? And that's part of the... I think that's part of the fascination of this crime is
the
that
intrigue.
This is right. This is a couple and a family that looks picture perfect, right? And how could something possibly go so wrong?
With a lot of friends too. This was a social couple. They had a lot of friends. They did a gender reveal with many people, surrounded by many people who seem to really love them when they learned that they were having a second child, their daughter. Yeah, from you know, everything that you can see online, it seemed picture perfect.
So let's assume that there's a lot of stress, that there's kind of a lack of resiliency in dealing with that. And by the way, some of his beliefs and his religiosity and his involvement in conspiracies would certainly suggest some rigidity, that this is someone who isn't really open, right? He's not really open-minded, which again, another fascination with this case is you've got this surfer dude, right? That like when you think of a surfer dude, you think of total freedom and
free spirit,
you know, hang five or whatever, just like put it out there, man, you
the
know,
world
go
is my playground.
Right. You know, go with the surf, you know, whatever. And like, and that's not, I think you've got something here that's actually quite contradictory with that. That's, you have a surfer dude who is probably very rigid and, probably not that open-minded. And so you've got another one of these huge contradictions. And one of the things I told Lauren early on in this case is I think there's a lot of conflict.
You lose weight, it comes back. You lose it again, it comes back again. And if this cycle sounds familiar, you're not alone. And there is a better way. What if you could take a weekly shot to lose weight and keep it off? That's where Ro comes in. Ro provides access to the most popular weight loss shots on the market. The Ro Body Program pairs a weekly shot with lifestyle changes so you can lose weight and keep it off. Ro handles it all, even insurance paperwork. If eligible, you have access to a provider on demand. You can sign up online from home, no doctor's visits. Average weight loss, get this, 15 to 20% in a year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria do apply. Go to ro.co/hidden. Sign up today and you will pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/hidden. While Chad Daybell's attorney complains of Tammy Daybell going through menopause in the courtroom, most women can relate to her experience. Many of us know it can be hard to find comfort in our own bodies, experience cravings or depression, but Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution for women of all ages. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. They help the body adapt to stressors like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any women with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today.
You know, there's probably a lot of internal conflict with this guy because, and this was just pure speculation in the beginning, because his parents are probably quite different.
Well, let me explain further. I showed John the news. I had known about it for a while and had already posted on Facebook about it, but you were working. And the moment I showed him the news article, it took less than about 3 minutes for him to say this. This is exactly what he said. Yes. And do you want me to share?
I don't remember exactly what I said.
Well, no, I want to share what I discovered. Well, what you shared is there's conflict. There's a lot of conflict in him. And I bet there's a lot of conflict in his family. I bet he has different types of parents. And I was like, okay. And then I did, again, do the research for us. And I found his mother and I found his father. They are divorced. I don't know when. I don't know that history. But their worldviews couldn't be more different. His mother and his father and their ideology and who they are is vastly different.
Right. And so that's an interesting clue. Of course, we don't know specifically how those belief systems affected him or those worldviews affected him. But I think their divorce is kind of a metaphor for his psyche, right? That the splits in his psyche are reflected in the differences in his parents in some ways. So you've got a lot of stress, you've got a lack of resiliency, you have some rigidity, and you've got this internal conflict, probably from these parents that were quite different and probably at war a lot during his childhood. One was very religious and conservative. The other was very liberal. So
that's one was an artist. The other
artist. The other is he owns a carpet cleaning business. So he's a businessman and very, you know, probably somewhat rigid. So the rigidity is interesting to me in the sense that he's going to lack a certain amount of resiliency, right? But it also suggests, if I'm right about that, it suggests that he doesn't deal well with uncertainty. And the reason that's important is because the two elements that predict whether people will follow conspiracies and the degree to which they will follow conspiracies, the two elements are fear and uncertainty. And those two often go together. So the best way we know of predicting that someone will become involved in a conspiracy are the way they cope with negative emotions and specifically with fear and uncertainty. Uncertainty is an interesting thing here, an interesting component of this, because if indeed Matthew Coleman has a certain amount of rigidity, which I think he does from looking at his history, then he's not going to deal with uncertainty well. And when you're talking about owning your own business, right, especially a surf mm-hmm. business, he's, you know, and they had employees, by the way.
Oh, yeah. This
they have multiple employees. So they have a payroll. There's definitely got to be some stress there. But, you know, I can tell you as someone who relies on referrals from attorneys and the courts and DAs that there's a lot of uncertainty about when the next call is going to come mm-hmm. with a referral, right? And his business must be much worse, because at least I've developed some networks that are fairly reliable, right? But his has to be uncertain in the sense that it's seasonal, right?
We're probably he's dealing with tourists.
He's dealing with tourists. You know, we're coming to the end of the summer. I have to imagine that the uncertainty of dealing with his business is probably a major stressor.
Throwing the pandemic.
The pandemic, right. And so you have those elements and the fear, you know, the fear of the future, the fear in some ways he said or the probable cause statement said that he was concerned about his children would grow up to be monsters, right? That's an immense fear of the future. He's already thinking many years ahead, and you have to wonder how that type of fear, that's being overly sensitive to fear, by the way. Like, you have to imagine, how does that fear come into play with his business? Is he thinking the same thing with his business? Is he thinking, my business is certainly going to fail? I'm not going to make this work. Is he thinking, right? Like,
his wife has serpent DNA.
Right. This is someone with a lot of, this is someone who's very fear-based. Right. And I mean, you know, you certainly don't get that from looking at his Instagram, but I think there's a lot of fear here. And so we see that definitely come into play, though, with the conspiracy theories and this real immense fear of his children growing up to be monsters, which is a really peculiar thing.
The probable cause actually stated that he knew they were going to become monsters and it was the only way he could save the world. Save the world.
So that's grandiose, but I don't know. Maybe there's, I didn't see that part. So thanks for enlightening me on that. Mm-hmm. But there's, that kind of grandiosity, by the way, would suggest some potential narcissism, which is maybe something we should keep an eye out for on this case.
I've been speculating that with my fellow true crime friends online was the narcissism bit, you know. That was speculated without you.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Heaven
forbid you go there without me. You know, the other interesting thing about conspiracies is that people who kind of have these extreme beliefs, and again, we don't really know if his religious beliefs were extreme or if they were moderate. We don't really know where he falls on that spectrum, but people with, you know, moderate to more extreme religious beliefs, when they become involved in conspiracy theories, there's some really interesting research showing that conspiracy theories become what's called a radicalization multiplier. So in other words, if somebody is already kind of out there a little bit with their beliefs, when they become involved in conspiracies, they get radicalized much more quickly, that they become much more extreme, much faster. And I think you have some of that here potentially, right? You have this guy who's dealing with all these stressors and
conflict.
He's
uncertainty,
right? Fear. And, he's got probably some, you know, reasonably extreme religious beliefs. You throw in a conspiracy theory and all of a sudden things just accelerate. And, you know, and that's how you kind of get to that point.
Okay.
So those are some of my initial thoughts. You know, there's one other reflection I would have about this situation, and I think this is relevant to conspiracy theories too, and especially to this case, but more specifically to mental health in general. And that is that there's a lot of research showing that the least mentally healthy people tend to be really paranoid. They tend to be really out there on the spectrum of mental illness, right? That paranoia, extreme paranoia, which is a type of fear too, right? It's a fear. It's a mistrust of other people, essentially. So right. It's an overly sensitive perception of the world that everyone's out to get you, that you can't trust anyone. You can't trust
a persecution complex.
I mean, paranoia is a little different. I mean, a little bit. Yeah, I think there's some overlap, but I mean, so mental health broadly defined, you know, on the two ends, with poor mental health being on one end, you'd see a lot of paranoia, and on the other end, you would see something like openness, like acceptance. The ability to stay open to new ideas, the ability to trust people. And that doesn't mean you trust everyone. I don't mean like naive trusting people.
Yeah, I don't trust everyone.
I mean a healthy dose of trust, like trusting people that show you they're trustworthy. I don't mean, you know, just openly trusting everyone. So I'm not talking about extreme openness. I'm talking about openness in the sense of being curious and generally trusting the world. Giving people the benefit of the doubt. People that have more mental health tend to be on that side of the spectrum. People with less mental health tend to be more paranoid. So I think you definitely have some mental health issues here in terms of the paranoia.
I'm trying to process the trusting people thing. Would it almost be like humanizing people in the sense that, let me see if I can figure this out. Groups of people, maybe like in general terms, you're not going to.
I think that would be part of it, but this goes back to our earliest years.
Okay.
This goes back to childhood attachment. This goes back to the first months of being on this planet and how our caregivers take care of us. Whether we develop a secure attachment to them or an insecure attachment to them. There's essentially two types of attachments. There's secure attachment and there's insecure attachment. Secure attachment generally is going to lead to trust. Insecure attachment is much more likely to lead to mistrust of others as a child and potentially paranoia as an adult if the insecure attachment is extreme.
Yeah, which is similar to Chad Daybell. What else are the similarities with this and the Daybell case? Because I think one thing that most people recognized with this case that are also following the Daybell case was how familiar it seemed. Children being zombies, children being monsters, conspiracy theories. You know, I know that in our first podcast episode on, you know, our main podcast, Chad Daybell you said had those insecure attachments, most likely. What else is similar with this and the Daybell case? Because it all, you know, are we going to keep seeing more of this too? It's just crazy. You know, the Daybell case was crazy. This is crazy. And they're happening not too far apart.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap. You know, the rigidity, right? Chad's extreme religious beliefs. He was very rigid, very close-minded. The fear, the way Chad dealt with or deals with uncertainty is to create this fictional universe that doesn't exist and then to say that he's going to go live in it. There's a lot of overlap. Chad also wasn't very resilient. Chad was generally seen as someone who was fairly unassuming and humble. And Matt Coleman is seen as someone who is somewhat happy-go-lucky and, you know, also somewhat humble. That he, I think he worked for some nonprofits for a while and he was a teacher. And you've got that element too, right? Like these aren't people that on the face of it would seem to be capable of killing children. And yet that's exactly what they did. So, and that's another lesson here, by the way. You know, one of the lessons of one of the great enduring lessons of true crime is sometimes what you see is not what you get. That when we make assumptions about people based on how they look and kind of their public personas and how they interact with others, even if they're super friendly and kind, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to represent their internal worlds.
We'll never learn that lesson. Every time that there's an unsolved crime case and it's clear who the suspect is, you're always going to have 10 friends saying, there's no way, who believes them to the very end, you know, whether it was Chad Daybell's neighbors or Lori's, you know, primary presidency or this guy's friends who have already spoken out and said they could have never seen this coming.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid and the Dahmer case broke and, you know, I lived in the Chicago area and I don't remember why I was watching the news. But I remember, I don't know why I'll never forget this, but you know, I think my mom had the news on and, we were kids and, you know, they were talking about what Dahmer did, that he killed people and ate them and all this crazy stuff. I don't think I understood what that meant, but I remember that the news station, which was up in Milwaukee, which was obviously close to Chicago, the reporter knocked on the neighbor's door and you had the classic, well, he seemed like such a nice guy. He was so kind and he kept to himself and he was such a good neighbor, right? Like, and I remember thinking, even as a kid, I remember thinking, but wait, he ate people. Mom, this doesn't make any sense. Like, well, how could he be such a nice guy?
I know Ted Bundy. So he converted to Mormonism. And a lot of his murders were committed in Utah. And my friend, who I went to high school with, his dad was his bishop, his ward bishop, and when he was arrested. And they were so concerned about him, they had the entire primary which is the kids, all the children, write him letters while in prison, letting them know that he'd be out soon. Sorry, yeah, it's random now that we're talking about this.
Nice,
but,
nice sentiment.
Well, so this is a tangent, but kind of a tangent. How do you?
Well, there's a moral here. Go ahead. There's a moral here. Now that we're talking about trust,
Don't trust people. Where we're going, but is how do you have trust in people when you can so clearly see, for example, when Chad Daybell's neighbors were all coming out saying, there's no way, I wanted to be like, oh my gosh, like you are going to be so disappointed shocked. That was a bad choice words. Shocked and upset and shaken when you realize he really did this.
Well, I'm not talking about blind trust. The issue here is that Dahmer and Ted Bundy and Chad Daybell and Matthew Coleman are showing you their public persona, right? We don't really know their private personas. We don't know who they are behind closed doors, obviously. And, you know, so trust has its limits. I think if, if they're going to ask you for a big favor, you're probably going to have to know them better than, you know, than simply seeing them coming and going from their house.
Okay, well, here's a question, though. His wife didn't seem to know his private persona, because when she called the police, her first concern was their well-being. Did something happen? Because he wasn't returning texts. But according to the probable cause, his wife, that first night when in talking to the police, did not believe that the children were in harm because of him. There was no concern that he would harm the children. And then we learn that he stabbed them multiple times. The girl, I think, it was 12 times, and the boy 17.
Right. So, you know, in extreme cases, the spouse doesn't know the person either. Like, this is someone who, again, let's get back to this idea of conflict. This is someone who had a lot of inner turmoil, and he probably hid it from his wife. That he had a lot of secrets. He was probably hiding a lot of stuff. I mean, again, you're assuming that most marriages are reciprocal, and that people, that spouses share stuff. I mean, just because we do it doesn't mean that everyone does it. That I'm sure there's plenty of marriages where, you know, one spouse has many, many secrets. So I think his wife probably didn't know him that well. And like you said, they weren't married that long.
Before they started having children, right.
Yeah. So I mean, in fact, it reminds me of, I don't remember the name of the show. I'm sure some of our listeners would remember, but there was a show on like IDTV about, you know, these spouses, people getting married and not knowing their spouse at all, who turned out to be like somebody completely different. I think it was like, I can't believe I married something. I don't remember. Anyway, it reminds me of that. There's actually an entire show devoted to the idea that sometimes people marry people with aliases that are completely different. They just don't know them at all.
This does lead me down the rabbit hole of trust, though. It does have me thinking, because at what point can you trust someone, and at what point can you trust the world? Because another example is this couple, in going down their social media history, you and I, John, we didn't even have a honeymoon. We eloped, and I think we were like sleeping in, you know, your parents' house the next day, taking care of some family business. But they did have a honeymoon, and they went for like 3 weeks to New Zealand. So they traveled overseas together, and it seemed very spontaneous, and they stayed in Airbnbs. And then there's another picture.
I'm going to interrupt you quickly. Okay. And say, look, we didn't need a honeymoon, because we started our honeymoon in the minute we met, right? So,
well said. Yes, yes.
So in that sense.
And it's been a honeymoon ever since, right? Yep. He's laughing.
Yeah, it's awesome being married to the delicate Venus flytrap.
Another story is, there's a picture on their social media. It looks like they're sleeping in the back of a van in Zion National Park. It seems that they're a very spontaneous couple who's spending a lot of time together. You get to know, you know, they say if you want to get to know someone, go travel with them, right?
I know. I mean, spending time together doesn't mean getting to know someone, though, right? Like, I mean, in some ways, I could argue that maybe that's preventing them from becoming closer. I think maybe the hardest thing to do with someone is to spend time alone and without going to do, you know, without doing all this stuff, but just to be in a room with someone and to talk and to get to know them and to really listen to them. You know, I think
without the exciting adventures.
Yeah, right. You know, in other words, like hiking and running around Zion National Park, in some ways would contradict that, you know, ability to develop intimacy or to really sit directly in front of someone and get to know them.
So it's a distraction.
It's a distraction. Yeah. It's the notion of staying busy or active to really avoid feeling something or to avoid really connecting to someone.
That makes sense. So back to the bigger question, which is one thing you asked earlier on, and then we can conclude and go to bed. But when you follow true crime and when you learn that people aren't who they seem, how do you trust people? What does it look like to be a trusting person and not get into this place of paranoia and fear and rigidity? You know, it's such a contradiction.
It's, yeah, you know, and I mean, I'm someone who works with the most, the most dishonest and the least trustworthy people on the planet. So I think it's a really interesting question. It still goes back to our early years. Like, that fundamental ability to trust or not trust is going to occur in the first couple of years of life. And I think for me, I think I was fortunate that I did develop a secure attachment, hopefully. And my natural tendency is just to trust people. And but of course, I'm always assessing, like, does somebody, what are they doing? How do I feel about that person in the room? Is there something peculiar? I remember 5 or 6 years ago, I was doing an assessment at Clark County Detention Center in Las Vegas. And there was a guy who had committed, it was fairly low level crimes. But I got in the room and I just had this really awful feeling. Like, I knew this was someone I couldn't trust. And, that's not like a rational thing, but like the kind of the hairs on your neck stand up type thing. Okay. Like, this guy was just really creepy. And even though his crime wasn't that bad, like, the creep factor was off the charts. And there was just something really insidious about this guy. Hmm. And to answer your question, some of it's going to be based on evidence and information and things that people do. So their behaviors and their actions, we're going to look at those and assess them. But some of it is going to be unconscious. Some of it's going to be based on our experiences with people and our relationships and intuition, which is basically, developing certain patterns of the way people are. And it's based more on emotion. And in this particular instance I'm talking about, clearly I knew there was something off, that this guy wasn't like the typical criminal. And I knew that he was deceiving me. And that turned out to be true, by the way. I learned a lot more about this guy later that I didn't know when I walked in that room. It's a tough question. I think it becomes problematic, though, when we start with the assumption that everyone is out to get us, that everyone is not trustworthy, it becomes a problem when we start with paranoia and we don't extend trust or the ability to trust, because then we have no capacity to form relationships.
That makes sense. The whole everyone is out to get me. That makes sense to me. And I think as a reporter and interviewing people, you have to give everyone you're interviewing trust. To be able to tell their truth and share things without critiquing them, or, maybe that's a bit of it too, is just believing people are who they are and to trust.
Yeah.
That they'll let you know that.
Oftentimes I'll walk in a room with some of the most hardened criminals and I'll start with that assumption of trust. In one of our podcasts, I talk about the story of being with a guy in death row who actually had assaulted previous evaluators. In fact, he almost killed one of them. And I was the guy next up to do his evaluation. And I talked about sitting on the other end of the table from the panic button to show him that I trusted him.
Right.
And so, I don't know. He walked in the room and I felt comfortable and he knew what was going on. He knew that I was sitting away from the panic button, and it worked out well. I think sending that initial signal of trust really, really helped that interview. So
even though you knew what he had done.
Yeah, I knew what he had done and I knew it was horrendous. And I knew that he had attacked the previous person that tried to evaluate him. Of course, I also learned that evaluator had no trust when he entered the room. That evaluator was actually quite defensive and angry.
So having trust in someone isn't necessarily a denial of who they are or what they did. You weren't, in order to trust him, you weren't pretending that he didn't do the horrible things he did.
Right. No, I knew those things. The trust was that it was built upon the idea that I could sit with him and listen to him and get to know him as a human being and get to know, listen to his story and really not try to judge him, right?
Right.
You know, that I wanted to really understand him. And I think he knew that. So, I mean, part of this is part of trust is building it, is earning it. Right? Like,
to not be so paranoid or believing that the world is out to get you that you can't go.
Yeah, exactly. If I walk in that room with paranoia, I have no chance of building trust.
Right.
You know, if I lead with, let me pull out your criminal record and repeat what you did, right? I mean, some people do that.
Huh. Yeah.
You know, that's not going to help my relationship with this guy. So I think for the most part, you know, with the exception of the creepy guy I talked about, and it was a hard interview. You know, I don't, with him, by the way, I wouldn't suggest that I was paranoid about what was going on in the room, but there was something there that was like his mannerisms were a little off too. And it was just a really unusual situation.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for exploring trust with me a little bit. I think that helped. I mean, I think there's still more to delve into, but I appreciate that. And exploring the basis or the basics of this Matthew Coleman case that also got our attention. And we decided that we do want to talk about it because of how the parallels to the case we're delving into.
Yeah.
Because of the parallels with the Daybell case, John and I always say, we don't want something like this to ever happen again. That's part of our goal with our podcast. And here something is that's happened that's eerily similar. So let's talk about it and try to figure this out.
Right. You know, there are many parallels with Daybell, except for I think the Daybell obviously wasn't, Chad Daybell wasn't, as far as I know, he wasn't caught up in as many conspiracy theories. So with Matthew Coleman, I think you have that radicalization multiplier that comes into play. And with Chad, you know, there may have been a little of that.
He was definitely down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, I'd say.
What do we know about that?
On the Avow website, Avow, everyone pronounces it differently. There was comments he made about needing to shoot zombies as they came from liberal Idaho Falls and wondering how they were going to do it. To me, that shows that that's sort of like the demonic, you know, the DNA or whatever, in that people outside of Rexburg, it implies a fear of them. You know, Idaho Falls is not very far from Rexburg, Idaho, for those that are wondering. And he's already labeled them as completely different than people in Rexburg. I thought that was interesting. You know, it wasn't like those liberal New Yorkers, it was the liberal Idaho Fallers. You know, it's like,
right.
You know, it's all East Idaho.
So I wonder what he would have done with liberal New Yorkers.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of fear and paranoia. I've heard this from multiple people on that Avow website. And I do think that there were conspiracy theories. And then Julie Rowe shares conspiracy theories on many of her podcasts. I've been going down the Julie Rowe podcast rabbit hole recently for a lot of reasons in my upcoming interview. And there are definitely conspiracy theories shared, some of them similar to this. She talks about reptilian or DNA as well. So I would actually say that, and I'm going to assume Chad held many of those beliefs since, according to Julie, they talked every day while writing her books. So there's a little bit.
Right. So that would have been another similarity with Matthew Coleman then.
Yes. Yes. And of course, Lori believed in these conspiracy theories too. We're talking about Chad because he's a male. we haven't been mentioning Lori as much because we're referring to paternal filicide, even though Chad wasn't the father of the kid. So we're, you know, but Lori was the parent, you know, so there's not a perfect parallel here. This is a dad of his biological children. Chad was a soon to be stepfather of the children and never became the stepfather, but was, you know, would have been. And then Lori was the mother. So it's not perfect, but it's the reasons and the motive are eerily similar. So.
And so would the intervention, by the way, like if the question is, how could this be avoided or how could you prevent this? And the answer is you'd have to address the paranoia and the fear and the rigidity, and you'd have to try to build some resiliency. I don't know if that's possible, but I think that would be the goal. So I don't, you know, it would be interesting, and we'll try to figure this out over time.
Yeah, we don't know his medical history.
Yeah.
We don't know, you know, this is just the basics.
This is just the start, yeah, that, you know, I'd like to know what, like, for example, did Matthew Coleman's friends see him as paranoid? Like, was there, you know, was there some paranoia going back to, like, his childhood or his adolescent years, right? Like, that would be really interesting to me. Like, when does the paranoia start? Clearly, there's extreme paranoia by the time he gets to the point where he's killing his kids, right? But, and maybe even, you know, there could be some schizophrenia. There could be some even more severe mental health issues going on. But
visions, and I think visions might have been mentioned in the probable cause that he had said he had visions. Let me confirm that. But I feel like I read that in one of the articles. I also want to say to someone, this, we do plan to do more on the Matthew Coleman case. So if there's anyone listening that knows somebody who knows him or somebody listening that does know him and you want to reach out, whether on record or off record, to share more information, please do at hiddentruecrime@gmail.com. So
I think it would be, it's an interesting question to analyze this in terms of mental illness, which is obviously our, you know, what we do. And then to try to figure out when did the mental illness begin? You know, when did the paranoia start? If there's schizophrenic features, when do those start? If there's narcissism, when does that start? Right. So the key to prevention is always to begin to notice when some of these things start to take shape, and then to try to get the person help. Right. Or to try to intervene in some way, or, you know, to at least take whatever those issues are and address them so they're less severe.
Yeah. These children were absolutely adorable. They were beautiful. They were full of life. I saw a lot of home videos, and it is heartbreaking.
It's a tragedy.
It is.
It's horrendous. And, you know, and again, like, our, you know, could it have been prevented?
I've been praying for the mother, you know, I can't imagine. So.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Anyway, we'll continue discussing this case, and we're both feeling better. I gave whatever I had to John.
Yeah. And now you can tell that I'm a little congested. So I'm trying to get over it.
But I think we're on the up, and then our sons had it, you know, and so, but we're all hanging in there and doing better. So thank you everyone for your support, and we'll be talking more soon. And I have a YouTube interview coming up that I'm editing. And then, babe, when is our next podcast? Not our YouTube video interviews, but podcast.
Yeah. So I have the outline done for our next podcast. It's going to be about Chad Daybell. I am working on a really big murder case right now that won't conclude, or at least my portion of it won't conclude until September 2nd. So, unfortunately, I think we're looking at September to get it out, but we are working on it. I'm just absolutely consumed by, a particular case right now, and I'll be very happy to get that report done and to have the ability to focus more on our work.
Yes, we'll all be happy to have you back. And thanks to your support, yeah, we will have him back, because he is going to be able to be taking fewer cases. He's kind of finishing up some last ones and some here and there, but it's exciting. We now can officially cut back a bit. So thank you.
And we have some big things planned, which I don't think we can talk about yet.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So I think, can I say that I was the...
Yeah, you can say the... Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I can say that I will be in an upcoming documentary on the Daybell case. That's really all I can say at the moment. But we're really excited about that. But we have some really interesting plans, or big plans, Lauren and I do, for something we're going to be doing together, and we're going to be announcing that fairly shortly. So thank you guys. You guys are really the Patreon. Our Patreon supporters are really the basis, or the foundation, for giving us some freedom to take on some better projects, or to focus more on some projects we want to. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Hello, Hidden Gems. For exclusive content, things Dr. John and I only dare say behind a paywall, become a Patreon member at patreon.com/hiddentruecrime. You'll find bonus episodes, early releases, and insider info. Thank you for your endless support.